nice to have you back, Ray, on this
podcast. Thanks, Nima. Good to be back.
Yeah. Let's get started with what's going on right now between Israel and Hezbollah. Yesterday, we've learned that there are a lot of pager bombing attack in Lebanon, and Lebanese are talking about that Israel is behind this type of attacks. But at the end of the day, if Israel is doing this, in your opinion, what they're seeking for, what's the main goal? Because when you look at those assassinations, and right now these type of attacks that mostly they can get the civilians in Lebanon killed, and nobody understands what would be the strategy behind this type of behavior on the part of Israelis if they did that.
Well, Nimi, you have some Israeli top leaders, and I dare say people in Mossad and the other intelligence agencies who want to have a war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, want to widen the war. Are they a little bit crazy to do that? I think they are, because they can't win. They've shown before they can't win against Hezbollah. So what are they trying to do? They're trying to get the United States in with both feet militarily in behalf of Israel to rescue them so that it becomes a war that they can then handle. The U.S. can't afford to lose, they think. Okay, so that's one faction of the Israeli government. Netanyahu, I should add, has a personal stake in this, because once he's removed from government, he goes to jail if the Israeli justice system is worth anything. He's very liable for that. And they probably have a bedroom suite ready for Netanyahu and his bride, because she's in it too. So he's got personal insight. Often that is the difference between war and peace, history shows. Now who else is there? There's the Israeli army. Now, I mean, they're sensible people. They don't want to get a bloody nose. They haven't done real well against Hamas down in the south. Do they want to really take on Hezbollah with all the missilery and the very sophisticated arms that Hezbollah now has? I don't think so. Two very high military officials have visited Israel from the United States recently. The head of CENTCOM and, let's see, the head of the JCS, General Brown. Now, what have they been counseling their counterparts in the Israeli military? No one knows. But I dare say there's evidence that our military, that is the U.S. military, has found a little bit of guts these days and had said to itself, do we really want a neophyte like Blinken to get us involved in two major wars, one in Ukraine and now one against Hezbollah? Do we really want that? I don't think we want that. So let's get rid of one of those aircraft carriers. Let's send that aircraft carrier back to ply waters opposite China, which they have done, okay? And let's tell the Israelis, look, we don't want to get involved in this thing any more than you do. We know how vulnerable you are. I mean, if the Houthis could wreak the havoc that they have, including a hypersonic missile, for God's sake, you might be judicious this time. We're not. If the president, Biden, and Blinken want to support what Mossad and the others want, that is a full-scale war, for their own reasons, well, they're going to have to drag us around screaming. Now, who is responsible for detonating all those little instruments? Well, that would be the Israeli intelligence service. I don't think anybody doubts that Israel is the only country capable of doing that. They'll be able to trace what firm in Europe put these things together and how it was infiltrated, or how the explosives were put in there, or it was rigged in such a way that what happened just yesterday and a couple today also, I'm told, how it happened. So this augurs ill for peace there, but so far Hezbollah has not risen to the bait. I think they will be compelled to attack, to react in some way, But if you follow the subtlety or the slowness in with which Iran has reacted to provocations that one would have thought would have led to major retaliation, my guess, and it's only a guess, is that Hezbollah will react, but it will react in such a way as not to be responsible for perpetrating a regional war, because that's exactly what Netanyahu, apparently people in Mossad, and other hard right people want, but not what the Israeli military wants. So we're really in a Donnybrook now. Who will prevail? Will Netanyahu be able to work his will on everyone, including the Israeli military? I don't know. I'm not an expert on Israel, but I think this is one of those rare times where there may be something approaching the nature of a coup. I'm not saying an overthrow of the Israeli government. I'm just saying the Israeli military standing up and says, look, it was sort of crazy what you made us do down there in the south, you know, against Hamas. Hamas can't be beaten. One of the Israeli generals has said precisely that. Hamas is an ideal. It can't be beaten militarily. And now we're not going to go against Hezbollah, because Hezbollah is armed in such a way that you too will regret it, Mr. Netanyahu. They could target our cities and there's no defensive. Yeah, we have this Iron Dome. This Iron Dome, the best state of the art when it came, now it's as porous as the defenses that allowed that Houthi, mind you, Houthi hypersonic missile to land in near Tel Aviv. So that's how I read that. It's a very dicey time. And when you have two fronts like Ukraine and Israel and Gaza and Hezbollah, you've got more than the people, the likes of Tony Blinken, can handle. I think Sullivan and the military have shown that they've been able to be relatively sane voices in the councils of the White House. And I think that the way they together reacted to Blinken's obvious wish to have authorization to hit deep into Russian territory, the military announced before Starmer knocked on the White House door, look, you know, there's no silver bullet here. There's no weapon that's going to change the tide of the war. Use what you've got. You've already got a lot of weaponry. Use what you've got in preparation for negotiations. Who said that? The Pentagon spokesman. What did he say? 2 hours before Starmer knocked on the door of the White House. And then the London Times has said that it was Sullivan who put the reins on Blinken and said, look, we're not gonna authorize this. Don't you know what Putin said yesterday? Yesterday, of course, was Thursday. This all went down on Friday the 13th, for whatever that's worth. And this time, our military, Sullivan, prevailed against what I call the crazies, the unwashed, the neophytes, like Blinken. That's an analogy, I think, to what could happen now with respect to widening the war in the Middle East. But more so because Sullivan has shown himself a little bit smarter than I thought he was. Why do I say that? He went to Beijing 4 weeks ago. Why did he go to Beijing? Well, I think he still harbored some idea that he could play the Chinese off against the Russians. Can you believe that? I mean, that's what they've been telling Biden all for 3 years. They go, you can play the... Well, yeah, I think he found out from the Chinese that's not going to happen, okay? So what's that? That's kind of a wake-up call for Sullivan, that if he gets involved in hitting deep inside Russia, not only does he have to contend with the Russians in Europe, he may have to contend with the Chinese of the South China Sea. They're showing themselves already to be very adventurous in challenging Philippine boats and those kinds of things on those manufactured islands, many of them. So I see some sense that there is an adult or adults in the room I see in this case it would be the military. And the last thing that I want to say here is that Biden has not talked to Putin since the 12th of February, 2022. Have Lavrov and Blinken talked? Just to say hi at various multilateral conferences, there's no tie there. The Russians don't think Blinken is worth talking to. I'll leave you to decide whether they're right or not. So is there a tie? There is a tie. Thanks be to God. Slava Bogu, as the Russians would say. Okay? Why? Because Belousov, the new Minister of Defense in Russia, got in touch with his opposite number, Lloyd Austin, our Secretary of Defense, at least twice in recent months. And it was to handle things that could have gotten out of hand. Now, was there this kind of contact recently with respect to the project of putting longer-range missiles that could hit deep inside Russia? I don't know, but I suspect there were. You know, I suspect the Russians made this clear, not only very vocally, which they did, not only with Putin saying it right out, which he did on Thursday, but maybe at that same time on Thursday, the Russians used whatever links they have, primarily to Austin, I would think, the military, and serve notice that, look, you know, rhetoric is one thing. Putin doesn't make empty threats, you know. And we would recognize or we would underscore, I'm imagining they would say this, the former British National Security Assistant to many British premiers or British prime ministers, actually he was ambassador to Washington. And what did he say? 3 days ago he said, well, everyone says the Russians are bluffing. Well, yeah, I could say that too. I could say the Russians are bluffing. The Russians are bluffing until the Russians are not bluffing. Then what are we going to do? Yeah. Well, we have noticed that the Russians are not bluffing. The question answers itself. When Russian national interests are involved, and as Putin has tried to make clear, NATO is clearly involved in whatever strikes hit deep into Russia. It can't be otherwise, and most people admit that because we have the technology, the wherewithal, the target data and everything else. And we have special software that even Storm Shadow needs, the English, the British missile, to be able to maneuver to its target. So it's the U.S. involved directly, as Putin warned. That's a bridge too far. Thank God that Sullivan, probably Austin, and the Russians and the rest of our military of theirs said, look, okay, we recognize this is a little bit strange. Tell Tony Blinken to go watch the movies tonight and have some popcorn. We're not going to do this. And somebody hold his hand so he's not mad and stamping his feet.
Ray, how do you see the role of the United Kingdom right now and the way they're trying to? Because right now it seems that France, together with the United Kingdom, are totally in favor of sending long-range missiles to Ukraine. And do you understand their behavior right now?
No. You know, I have lots of friends in the United Kingdom. They don't either. I mean, some of them say, well, Starmer's is not really with it. He's not very prepared. He doesn't know much about the ups and downs of all this stuff. The French are a riddle, of course. The president of France is in great trouble politically. That for the first time in the history of the Fifth Republic, somebody has moved to impeach him, for God's sake, you know. So I don't know exactly why the British, and maybe they're just trying to be out in front, show how devoted they were. And then when they're turned down, they can say to their populace, well, we tried, you know, it was the Americans that chickened out. You know, they wouldn't give us the permission or the wherewithal. I just don't really know. That's sort of idle speculation on my part. But I will attest to the fact that I've asked all my friends in Britain. I don't have many in France, so I didn't consult any French analysts. But Yeah, they're as much in the dark about that as I am, frankly, although they come up with all kinds of hypotheses. It's a good question. I wish I knew the answer to it.
And the question is right now, Stoltenberg had an interview with the Times in which he said he's in favor of what's the position of United Kingdom together with France. Stoltenberg.
Oh, Stoltenberg.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's in favor of sending these missiles to Ukraine to use them against Russia because he sees that there is no red line considering Russia, because anytime Putin is talking about red lines, it doesn't matter. They can just cross the red lines that nothing going to happen. But Ray, we know how Putin is so sensitive when it comes to killing Russian people. One of the reasons that this military operation, the special military operation, is taking too much time because they're not willing to suffer a lot on the part of Russian army because they don't want to lose their soldiers in this conflict.
Right. That's right.
And if they hit deep into the Russian soil and kill Russians, and that would hugely change the nature of the conflict. That's why I do believe that that's not a red line that can be crossed in the eyes of Russians.
Well, let me first say a word about Stoltenberg. He was prime minister of Norway. And Putin, about 3 months ago, commented, Stoltenberg, yeah, I remember him. I dealt with him when he was president of Norway. And he showed no signs of madness, or what's the word? He showed no signs of being a little bit off the rocker then, but now he is, he's not a good bellwether. I mean, he says stupid things. He's on his way out. And for him, it's the classic case of the Russians are bluffing. The Russians are bluffing. When they're not bluffing, what does that mean for Stoltenberg and Norway? Oops, well, I thought they were bluffing. They're way up in Norway. They're not going to be the first targets, right? So I think the Russians kind of, although their backs are up when Stoltenberg utters this nonsense, and he's a spokesperson for people like the Poles would really like to do something confrontational with Russia, I think the Russians have been able to persuade our military that this is a really bad idea. Now, let's just hypothesize that whatever it is driving Stormer, that the British decide, we'll go ahead and we'll launch one of those Storm Shadow missions anyway, without express permission from the U.S. And it gets through there. What are the Russians going to do? Well, the first thing any Russian military analyst would say, oh my God, well, how many did they have? Don't have many at all. How many do the French have? Well, the French have these similar things, but they don't have many of those at all. Well, the Germans have that Taurus, would they? No, Scholz has said three times now they're not going to use the Taurus. What about ATACMS? Oh, well, ATACMS, the Americans are not going to use any more ATACMS. So what I'm saying here, Nima, in my view, these are pinpricks. I don't think anybody's going to get to hit the Kremlin, okay? If that happened, there might be more than a pinprick. But right now, Putin and the Russians are in the driver's seat. They are winning handily in the east as they expand their alliance beyond the Donbas now, where they could go to the Dnieper River probably in just a couple of weeks if they so chose. So if you're in the driver's seat and you see people trying to provoke you into doing something that you don't really want to do. You don't want to rise to the bait unless you really have to. And you can suffer pinprick after pinprick. And you could, people say, oh, Putin being a lot of pressure. Yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of pressure. Maybe his approval ratings go down from 80 to maybe 75%. Won't that be terrible? He's got this thing in hand. And most Russians, I think, support his gradualism. As you say before, Russian troops have been spared for the most part. This, you know, just gradual going forth in Donbas has been able to keep Russian casualties low. And in Kursk, you know, that celebrated change of the narrative when Ukrainians entered the sparsely populated and ill-defended oblast or region of Kursk. Well, the head of the CIA and the head of MI6, oh, that changed the narrative. Oh, man, that changed the narrative. Okay, was that what we're about? Is that what intelligence agency is supposed to do? Be happy when we change the narrative? No, it's to look at the situation on the ground. And, you know, I feel for the Ukrainians who were persuaded to do this march of the, you know, this strange march into Kursk. I was thinking of the brigade that went into in Crimea, the March of the Light Brigade, right? It was that kind of thing. And most of them, well, I think about half of them have already been killed, and the others will be swept up and taken prisoner unless they're able to sneak back across the Ukrainian border. So again, I put myself in Putin's place and I say, well, look, I don't want those long-range missiles coming into them. So I'm going to warn in the strongest kinds of terms. Maybe I'll get through this time. And he did, okay. I think he probably had his Minister of Defense call up Austin and say, look, this is not bluffing. This is for real. Don't take any chances, okay? Now, even if that were countermanded, or even if the British went off on their own, or the French, or whoever, it's pinpricks. They don't have enough of these missiles to sustain any real offensive. The big thing is they're not going to change the trajectory of the inexorable Russian win in Ukraine. And, you know, if further proof were needed of that, there was that very interesting intercepted conversation where the most senior officers of the Bundesluftwaffe, the German Air Force, you know, we're talking, one was in Singapore, and anyhow, I don't know who got the transcript, but one of them says, you know, this is all political, for God's sake. Yeah, we would have to be in there, and they don't want us in there. So when you brief the prime minister, or you brief the chancellor, be aware this is all political, and most important, it's not going to change the trajectory of the war one whit. That's what this German senior Air Force officer said. And I have to agree that that is the case. So it's all, you know, showing how determined you are to prevent the inevitable defeat of Kiev, whatever it comes, surely within the next couple of months. And then maybe part of the game is to be able to say, well, we did everything we could. We tried everything we did. Every missile we had, we let them shoot off. It's not going to change anything. So I think Putin's not going to rise to the bait, but he has put down some cards here. And I think he's probably reassured that someone in the White House took it seriously. He can't account for Stoltenberg or the Poles or the Baltic folks. And those people still press for this. And perhaps they'll in the end win. After all, Biden changes his mind, right? Maybe Blinken will resurrect and in his very, very persuasive way say, no, Joe, we have to do this. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think it would be a real challenge to persuade our military to begin such a foolish endeavor.
There is an article, Ray, in Le Monde. It says that Zelensky's victory plan that was talking about with Biden, one of the points is he's asking for an invitation to NATO before Biden leaves in his office, before leaving the White House. Can we speculate, can we predict what would be the reaction? Would Biden do that? Would he invite Zelensky and Ukraine into NATO, or he's not willing to do that from what's seen so far?
He might want to do that, Nima, but he's incapable of doing it. He can't do that. That would require a unanimous vote on the part of NATO. That's what makes this whole thing ridiculous. Ukraine is not going to get into NATO. It's just not going to. Okay? And no matter how many times Tony Blinken says, oh, yeah, we're going to make Ukraine a member of NATO, that's not going to happen. Why? Because unanimity is needed on a decision like that in NATO. And you have several. The Hungarians are not the only ones. They're the Slovakian people in Slovakia. The Italians, the French, the Germans, they don't want any part of having Ukraine in NATO. And it couldn't possibly be in NATO when it's still at war, and it's still at war. And so this business about it's inevitable. They came up with a fancy word. It's inevitable, a word like that in their communique. But, you know, it's not going to happen. And the whole thing, sort of, if you rely on the prospect that Ukraine will become part of NATO, well, that has to go. In other words, when it did go, when Ukraine finally said, look, all right, we'll be neutral like we were before, okay? What happened? There was going to be a ceasefire, okay? The date was early April 2022, okay? The negotiations had taken part in Belarus and then in Istanbul in Turkey. Okay? They came to an agreement and initialed it. What did it say? Ceasefire, Russian troops withdraw from Ukraine. Limits on armaments that would be okay to put in the general area, and neutrality for Ukraine. What about Crimea and all those other sticky things? We're going to talk about that later, maybe 10 years from now. Let's have a ceasefire. That was all set to go. And what happened? As you know, and as a lot of your viewers know, the U.S. and the U.K. put the kibosh on it. They said, no, 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 we're going to fight. And Boris Johnson came into Kiev on the 8th of April, accompanied in time-wise at least by John Brennan, the head of the CIA, the same time, April 2022. And they persuaded Zelensky, who probably was smarter than this, but they said, no, no, we're not going to support you if you agree to these things. And otherwise, we'll support you forever and for as long as it takes. And we have lots of weaponry. And Zelensky bought into that at the expense of his own people and at the expense of 500,000 people already dead since April 2022. So you've heard me expound on that before. You've heard me talk about how the Ukrainian negotiator, for God's sake, gave an interview a year ago saying chapter and verse of what I just said. Okay, now we have Victoria Nuland admitting it. I don't know if you saw that, but she's on YouTube and she's talking to this interviewer. And she's got this big smirk on her face when he asks her, well, you know, what happened to that agreement that was initialed that almost signed him? And she says, well, we looked at it very close. They asked not only for an internal review, but outsiders to come in. And we looked at it and we saw that the Russians would be able to keep some of their armaments, and there were limits on the Ukrainian argument in this annex. And so they decided, smirk, smirk, not to do it. I don't know how someone like that lives with their conscience, if they have one, given that in the wake of that decision, which was, you know, when people say, well, how do you explain that, Ray? Well, it's very easy. This is not about Ukraine, for God's sake. It's about Russia. And at about the same time, our defense secretary, Austin, admitted precisely that, saying that our strategic purpose here is to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. That's what it's all about. And as Aha Rahmania, the Ukrainian negotiator in Istanbul, admitted, Boris Johnson came in, he said, no, no, don't sign that. Let's just fight. His quote. Here we are.
Yeah. Ray, again, we have 2024 presidential election, and everybody's talking about Russian interference in the US election. in the mainstream media. And we had Hillary Clinton on MSNBC. She was talking about this. I'm going to play a clip.
Oh, good. Yeah, that would be good to play that clip.
What she said.
As Mueller indicted a lot of Russians who were engaged in direct election interference and boosting Trump back in 2016. But I also think there are Americans who are engaged in this kind of propaganda. And whether they should be civilly or even in some cases criminally charged is something that would be a better deterrence because.
She's talking about civilly or criminally charged because of pro-Russian ideas, pro-Russian.
You know, as I was on the internet a half hour ago, what is going on now in Washington? Are they talking about nuclear weapons or trouble in the Middle East or Ukraine or the South China Sea? No, they're talking about, the Senate Intelligence Committee is talking about election interference in 2024, the threat to the elections. That's the name of the foreign threat to 2024 elections. They're all buying the same stuff that occurred back in 2016. It was shown to be cockamamie. Now, most people remember these Russian bots, you know, these bots and all these things that they bought to go onto, what was it, Facebook at the time and all that stuff. Well, we looked at that, and even relatively real experts looked at that and said, well, okay, yeah, they paid a couple hundred dollars, a couple thousand dollars for those bots, you know. It was the internet farm that was in St. Petersburg, yeah, and it accounted for, get this, 0.00000017 of the total material available to Americans to look at. The codicil of that is, what do they think of Americans that they would buy this stuff? You know? And here I would just refer back to what Eisenhower said about the military-industrial complex. He said, the only way that you can even hope to prevent them from garnering excessive power and endangering our democracy is a well-informed citizenry. And that's not what we have here. And I think I've said my new acronym for the MIC, the military-industrial complex, the military-industrial congressional media / Maddow academia think tank. I added Maddow there today because it's so, she is at the core of this whole thing, okay? I remind listeners that before Trump took office, but after he had won, Maddow was enlisted by Chuck Schumer to make sure that Trump and his people that he brought in, these real estate guys from New York, that they knew who was running Washington, okay? And so Trump is making some disparaging remarks about the intelligent people. Can you imagine that? Disparaging remark. So Chuck Schumer calls up Rachel, same Rachel that you saw there, interviewing Hillary. And he says, Rachel, I got to come in and tell you this, sell you something. So he comes in and Rachel says, Chuck, this is all in air. Okay. This is the 2nd of January, 2017. Okay. Trump had won, but he hadn't taken office. So what does Rachel say? She says, Chuck, what is it that you do? Well, Chuck says, you know, I thought that Trump was a pretty clever businessman and that, you know, he knew which end was up, but he's done something really foolish. Oh, what's that, Chuck? He's taken on the intelligence community. And the intelligence community has 6 ways to Sunday to get back at you. Oh, Chuck, next question, different subject. Well, why didn't she say, Chuck, do you mean that the incoming president has to be afraid
of the intelligence community? She didn't have to say that, because that's exactly what he was saying. And it would have been completely right, because the intelligence community, in connection with the other parts of the deep state, the Department of Justice, FBI, and so forth, had done all they possibly could to make sure that Hillary won and that Trump lost. And then when he came in, they made sure that they emasculated him to the point where he couldn't do anything useful with respect to Russia. He wanted to have a decent relationship with Russia. And what Trump just said and what he's campaigning, I think it's a good idea. I think most Americans would say, well, let's try it, you know. Well, he wasn't allowed to do that, okay? Now the same game is being played with one big exception. And I find this really kind of, I'm very happy about it. The crucial charge against the Russians back in October already, November, December 2016, was that they hacked into the Democratic National Committee, took those emails so damaging to Hillary. So damaging, why? Well, because they showed that Bernie Sanders didn't have a snowball's chance in hell to become the candidate. The DNC and Hillary had stacked the deck against him so obliquely that he never had a chance, okay? So what happens? Well, somebody gets a hold of those emails and gives them to WikiLeaks, and they're published right before the Democratic National Convention. My God, 3 days before, what are they going to do? Well, they blame it on Russia, okay? They said Russia hacked them. There was no evidence then, and now the evidence is that the Russians did not hack them. Nobody hacked them, and that's in sworn testimony by a fellow named Sean Henry, who headed up, or still does, the CrowdStrike outfit, that for some reason the head of the FBI, James Comey, deferred to do the forensics on the DNC laptops or the computers and their servers. So on the 5th of December 2017 now, there was sworn testimony by Sean Henry. He's asked by Adam Schiff, so, Mr. Henry, tell me how the Russians got in there and hacked those things. And you can see it was really interesting. He said, well, and his lawyer, Mr. Schiff, there's no technical evidence that the Russians hacked those email. There's no technical evidence that anyone hacked them. They weren't hacked. But there's circumstantial evidence, because this is the kind of thing the Russians do. Okay, but we don't have any technical evidence. Now, what am I saying here? I'm saying that has been suppressed. That testimony was kept under wraps for 2.5 years by Adam Schiff as he headed the House Intelligence Committee, and then was kept since it was unclassified, released with a group of 50 other documents. On, let's see, May 7th, 2020. Has it appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post? No. So most people, you go down the street and ask people, what do you think about the Russian hacking in 2016? Oh, terrible. 80% on an informal survey still believe that. And what's my point here? Well, we thought they'd never stop using this, but now they have. In other words, here's Hillary, several minutes with Rachel, and she's saying all kinds of interference and all kinds of creating uncertainty and as they usually say, creating doubt and sowing discord. But she never says anymore, Russia's hacked into those computers. And what happened was someone with access to the DNC computers had a little thumb drive or some other external storage device, stuck it in there, copied it. When you copy something, there's no trace that goes out on the internet, so nobody can find it. That's why there's no evidence, okay? Put it in his pocket, took it to WikiLeaks, where it was used. Now, What I find interesting is that they're still on this kick about how bad the Russians are, but they've come off this explicit charge, which was the cornerstone of everything. I mean, Obama kicked out 35 Russian diplomats for hacking. It confiscated two Russian properties, for God's sake. And he knew because we have testimony now, we have documents showing that even before CrowdStrike, cyber firm, came up with any forensics at all, Obama leaned on James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, and Jay Johnson, who at the time was Department of Homeland Security Chief. They were forced to put out a memo on the 7th of October saying hacking, 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 before CrowdStrike had ever made a report to the FBI. And in the final analysis, get this, Nima, CrowdStrike never gave a final report to the FBI. But that suited James Comey just fine, because James Comey was in the business of making sure that Trump didn't win, and then making sure that Trump didn't do anything against James Comey. Now, last question. How in the world did the head of the FBI, the acting head of the Department of Justice, the head of the CIA, how did they think they could get away with this stuff? This illegal interference in a presidential election, we got clear as a bell. Well, it comes right out in what James Comey wrote in a book about 2 years after all this went down. He says, oh, quote, I was operating in an environment in which Hillary Rodham Clinton was sure to be the next president of the United States, period, end quote. Well, if that's the environment that you're operating in, you can take all kinds of liberties with the law, with the regulation, with moral code, and you can interfere to a fairly well in the election, okay? And what's going to happen to you? Nothing, because when she wins, maybe you'll become attorney general, you know, or maybe you'll become director of national intelligence. You're not going to get indicted. Now, just a little footnote to that. The people who did this are still around. As far as I know, they're still living in this country. And not only Trump, but J.D. Vance have made it very clear that they're going to clean house, you know. They're going to go after people that they think, and that I agree, were responsible for killing President Kennedy. Now, that's throwing down the gauntlet. Let's say Trump survives the third attempt, or the fourth and the fifth attempt on his life. I say that not casually. I think that's going to happen. When he comes in, these people have a whole lot to lose, okay? And that's why, specifically, these people have this personal stake in what happens in the election, and by extension, what happens in Ukraine, because if Ukraine goes down to defeat ignominiously, they're going to lose the election, and they might lose their freedom if this other fellow comes in and is as vindictive as most people think he is. Before I forget, let me put a context on this, why all this is important. People ask me what I was going through all this and documenting this and talking about how the FBI gate, where two of the, a lawyer for the deputy director and Peter Strzok, number two at counterintelligence, they had this little romance going on, and they exchanged all kinds of emails, and they came out, but nobody knew about them. Nobody knows about them still, okay? But it was very clear that they were plotting all this stuff to let Hillary off with what she did with her email servers and to get Trump. Now, why was I so, people said, obsessed by this? Well, number one, I like to try to get at the truth, no matter which way the chips fall. But number two, Russia has nuclear weapons. Now, we have never challenged another nuclear power, we being the United States, since the Cuban Missile Crisis. When we did challenge the Russians, and they backed down. And after that, 5 months or so after, John Kennedy made that wonderful speech on June 10th, 1963. I had just 4 months before joined the CIA. And what Kennedy said is, look, we almost destroyed the world, okay? That feels bad. So what we need to do is recognize that every culture, every political system has something good in it, that we all want the same things for our children, okay? And practically speaking, the most important thing is never to give another nuclear power a choice between humiliating retreat and using nuclear weapons. Okay, why do I mention that? I mention that because these guys that I've been just describing, who Trump knows about, who J.D. Vance knows about, who they're being, as Chuck Schumer would say, very foolish in being forward-looking and very loud and say, well, we get these guys, okay? Well, these guys got all kinds of ways to get them still. Chuck Schumer was right about that, too. So when Ukraine really starts going down, let's say it's a month from now, and there's no hope for it at all, it's going to look very bad for the Democrats to have wasted $150 billion, with a B, dollars on this enterprise. And you know, what were they going to do? Well, they're going to paint the Russians as interfering in the election, just like they did, in quotes, in 2016, right? And they're going to prepare the American people for war with Russia. And why do they need to be prepared? Because I think these young neophytes, Blinken and Sullivan and those guys, that rather than lose the election, or lose the war in Ukraine, they would be tempted, sorely tempted, to use the only weapon they have left, and that is a small nuclear weapon. I know that sounds really strange, would we? Well, yeah, it would be a choice for us this time between a humiliating defeat, a humiliating retreat, was JFK's word, and using nuclear weapons. I think that whether I'm right or not, that Putin probably thinks the same. And if he doesn't, I think his generals have to think the same because they look at military capabilities, not political intentions. And so here, if I'm Putin and I'm looking at all this and I see that, hey, the Senate Intelligence Committee spent all day looking into intelligence interference by Russia and RT in what we're doing in the election, you know, it's not funny. This would give him the idea that, that we're preparing the American people who are already pretty well brainwashed on how bad, evil Putin is. They give them the underpinnings for justifying, in quotes, the kind of thing that I think these people are not above doing, that is employing a small nuclear weapon. That's why I think Putin is repeatedly saying, look, please remember, we have them too. We not only have them, but we've exercised them recently. We've exercised them with Belarus. They're on standby, for God's sake. Don't even think of it. Well, I hope he succeeds, and I hope that this link between Belousov, the defense minister in the Kremlin, and Austin in the Pentagon, still works, and that that can serve to prevent strange things, crazy things, like what I hope has just been prevented, and that is the use of U.S. technology in Western weaponry to hit deep inside Russia, which, you know, maybe is bluffing. Do we really want to find out if Putin is bluffing? I don't think so, not in their home territory.
Ray, just to wrap up this session, we had Anthony Blinken together with Lamy visiting Kiev recently. And we had resignation of the foreign minister of Ukraine, And we have a new foreign minister right now in Ukraine who's asking to be part of his. He says that the European Union should consider Ukraine. They should consider already Ukraine is part of the European Union. And how do you see this concept on their part, on the part of the Zelensky administration? I'm changing the question, because I think right now what Ukraine is seeking for, being part of NATO, being part of the EU, we've talked about NATO. And how about the EU? Do you see any sort of sign in the European Union that they're willing to accept Ukraine being part of the EU?
They would say, yes, we'd love to have you, but you have to fulfill these requirements, okay? The first requirement is, you can't be at war, okay? And then there are about 18 other requirements, none of which Ukraine can fulfill at this point. So they'll make nice talk and say, oh, sure. And as a matter of fact, would the Russians object? No, that was part of the deal in Istanbul in early April 2022. The Russians said, well, EU, don't you want to join the EU? The EU wants to have you be our guest. NATO, niet. Niet means niet, okay? So there's a big difference between a military alliance, NATO, right on the doorstep, right as a bulwark for NATO in Ukraine. And what I've been suggesting, or I have this little dialogue with a fellow named Robert Scheer, and he plays the part of president, and I do my old role of briefing the president. And I've been suggesting to him that, you know, in your last 4 months, and that's, don't forget, Biden still has 4 months, you ought to just call up Putin and say, hey, let's talk about this stuff. What's the risk here? Let's just talk about this stuff. Biden prides himself on personal engagement. Maybe he's not up to it, but why does he just try? Because I think that Putin is looking for a solution that's short of having to occupy all Ukraine, for sure, even short of having to occupy much more than he already has, for God's sake, okay? And his terms are very clear. He wants to keep control of those four provinces. The Ukrainian forces withdraw, and they can talk. So it's not like those are insurmountable obstacles to talking. So, you know, I'm just thinking that that would be an option. And if progress toward a peaceful resolution was seen even before the election, then Biden might not, or Harris might not, suffer so much from having gotten us into something $150 billion worth of wasted effort in a demolished country, and no listening to people who warned about this from the beginning. I just finished this with this and say, John Mearsheimer, 10 years ago in Foreign Affairs magazine, you know, the epitome of the establishment periodicals, said that the West is responsible for what's happening in Ukraine. They will bear the blame for whatever happens. And if the West doesn't change its tune about admitting Ukraine to NATO, this will end up in the utter destruction of Ukraine. Now, look at Ukraine now, half destroyed. And I had a chance to ask John in a public forum. I think I knew what the answer was, but I wanted to ask him so everybody knows. I said, John, you were quite right about that. And it was not like your views were secret. Were they sought after? You're in Washington right now. I said, John, has anyone contacted you to talk to you from the State Department, the CIA? And he smiled and he says, are you kidding? No one has ever contacted me. No one from government has ever asked for my views or even to share a cup of coffee with me, never. And thereon hangs a tale, okay? Because the ingrowth of these pseudo specialists on Russia and international relations. They don't know much about these things, and they're unwilling to branch out and find out some advice from really smart people like Mearsheimer or Jeffrey Sachs. For those of you who have not seen their little debate of just 3 days ago, it is a masterpiece, and you ought to really see it. So, and it's great that you have those people on too, Nima. So I see ourselves at a very critical time. And domestically, I see we're still trying to make Russia into the bad people. Hillary Clinton, just add one other thing about Hillary. Not many people know this, but right after January 6th, you know, the disturbances where Congress was invaded by this unruly crowd and so forth, Hillary arranged for herself to be at a radio interview with Nancy Pelosi. I think I may have exactly what, yeah. So Pelosi and Hillary are talking about what happened on January 6th. And out of the blue, Hillary Clinton says, you know, I'd love to see Trump's phone records for that day to see whether he was talking to Putin on that day when the insurgents had invaded our capital. She continued, we now know that not just him, but his enablers had accomplices. His accomplices, his cult members, have the same disregard for democracy. Okay, so she raises that, and Pelosi said, gosh, Hillary, that's a great idea. And as Pelosi says, yes, as I said to him in that picture, the picture with my blue suit, as I was leaving, I said to him, pointing rudely at him, do you remember my blue suit? Rudely, with you, Mr. President, all roads lead to Putin. So here's the top Democrat in Congress. Maybe she believes this stuff. I mean, she's been brainwashed, but I thought she was smarter than that. So she and Hillary saying, just a week after the insurrection, really, there on the 6th, that Putin must have had something to do with it. And Pelosi goes on to say, you know, we ought to have an investigation. And Hillary says, yeah, that's a really good idea. Of course, they did have an investigation. I found it fascinating. And I found it very disturbing because most of that stuff was true. And the notion of somebody coming in again with that kind of attitude toward the Constitution bothers me greatly. So I'll let me just say again, my shtish is trying to get at the truth. Whether it hurts or helps this or that candidate, I have the luxury of saying, I don't care. I'm getting at the truth. And in 2016, things really went awry. The same people who made things go awry, playing fast moves with our Constitution, our laws, and so forth, are still around. Warning, they could still get Trump before the election. I think chances are 50-50. They'll try. But in any case, if Trump comes in, there's going to be trouble because it's the deeply embedded deep state. And if you want a good definition of that, I refer you once again to the little dialogue between Jeffrey Sachs and John Mearsheimer 3 days ago. They asked that question and they give as good an answer as I could or anyone else could. So the deep state is with us and they're watching this as we speak. And I just hope that we will be able to keep on the airways. And I hope I haven't said anything, Nima, that will get you into trouble.
Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.